and welcome to New in Events, a podcast from IBTM with me, Shanali Devereaux. This is your go-to podcast for fresh insights and practical takeaways, whether you are new to the meetings, incentive, conference and events sector or a seasoned professional. You'll hear from industry leaders, discover innovative solutions, explore evolving trends and get inspired to take your events to the next level. So let's get on with the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this exciting episode all about experiences. Today, we are going to be talking about why experiences are so powerful and how can we harness that power from a venue POV and also from an organizer POV. I am delighted to be speaking to Damien Norman today, who is a director of immersive entertainment and events at XL London. They have launched Immerse London, which is a multiplex venue of experiences, who have already hosted Jurassic World, the exhibition, Disney 100, currently Friends is on and Tutankhamun. And from July, they'll be hosting the highly anticipated Elvis Evolution, and later in the year, Squid Game, along with many, many more. And then we go over to speak to Kat Bottibol, who runs Studio Secret Cinema. Secret Cinema itself has been running for 17 years, but Studio Secret Cinema is an experiential agency designed to understand how you bring that immersion into your business events. We talk about all sorts of stuff. We talk about collective awe. We talk about effervescence. And we talk about looking ahead, seeing what's on the horizon for 2028 to design the best experiences for now. I hope you enjoy.
The Royal Docks is an incredible part of London. It's one that's been a bit of a sleeping giant, really, in that it's so close to the city and yet so untapped in terms of opportunity. If you think that the waterfront here, XL, we've got a kilometre that had pretty much been left, other than running a boat show or occasionally doing some things, we've never, ever focused on this waterfront. We've always been focused on the box and the exhibition halls and all of the above. With the arrival of the Elizabeth Line, suddenly it gave us a right to play in the leisure space rather than just being a necessity journey to come to a trade show or a conference or something. If we've got that connectivity from a transport point of view, and we've got this incredible expanse of water where we get sunrise and sunset, which is incredibly rare for London, what will we do with it? What's that opportunity? What tone of voice should we have in the entertainment industry? What should we do and how should we enter it?
This feels like using the purpose of the hall, the fact that you have this brilliant built environment, this opportunity, this gorgeous space, and figuring out what's going on in the world of events and then just bringing the two together.
When I first started looking at this about 5 years ago, I went to a immersive art exhibition in Hyde Park, Van Gogh. And I went to it and I stood there and there was a little five-year-old girl and there was this 75-year-old woman and there was me. And they synced the visuals to music and we just stood there watching it. And I looked at the look on their faces and I looked at the look on my face. Wow, this has got the ability to captivate multi-generations. It's got the ability to display something that would be a static piece of art on a wall that the five-year-old would look at and just walk past. And it's storytelling and you're learning and it's interesting. And then the different elements of it. And I remember spending 2 hours there, coming away going, okay, this is really interesting. It's right after COVID or in the midst of one of those lockdowns of COVID. So I started looking at it going, well, what else is there? What is this space? And why would it be interesting? So I started meeting lots and lots and lots of people, going to lots of things and just asking questions and finding out the different areas of what that market is.
What questions did you ask? The thing that struck me when you were talking about the visual and it moving and it being coordinated to music, what it made me think about was the evolution of storytelling. Previously, that Van Gogh would have been in a museum. You'd have to go into the physical museum. It might feel like a space where you perhaps were or weren't welcome, depending on whether you thought you were high culture or not.
100%.
And then it would have to be explained via a tiny little plaque in black and white. Yeah. And then there'd need to be an expert to go, well, this is how you can interpret it. Or this was his life. Or this is that. So you could make a connection to the painting. But actually, storytelling has evolved. So that connection is made in different ways. So how did you get to the bottom of what connects people?
The little plaque thing that you mentioned is funny because that's completely true. Everyone gathered around this one painting. There's a tiny little plaque telling you, in a very short, succinct way, what this artist did. It just undersells it. It doesn't tell the story in a way. And you think if Vincent van Gogh was alive and he had the disposal of digital and everything, what would his exhibition look like? It wouldn't be a little plaque. It wouldn't be a painting. It would be an explosion of creativity. What's happening in immersive art specifically is people are taking old masters and they're digitalizing them and they're putting a bit of animation in and they're sending it to music and they're doing that. But it is just looking at history and recreating that in a digital sort of space. That's the kind of now and has been for a few years. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be the future. And I think there's a future for digital art, and it's about digital artists now designing for digital first, not recreating something that was painted or drawn, and actually saying, well, what does this space look like in 2028? And I think for me, I'm not interested in 2025. 2025 is half done. Show me what 2028 looks like. Show me what 2030 looks like. So if in VR, what we're doing in 2025 is just shooting zombies in VR headsets, what are we doing in VR in 2028? Are we escaping into different worlds? How does that storytelling work? And there are lots of exciting people in the space starting to push those boundaries. And it's not yet here, but it's coming and it will be.
Where do you go for your inspiration? There are lots of exciting people in this space, as you mentioned. How do you figure out what 2028 looks like without, I feel really old school by saying consulting a futurist, but it must be through experiencing and synthesizing.
2 weeks ago, through the WXO, the World Experience Organization, they hosted London Experience Week, which is the first time, backed by London Partners as part of the mayor's 10-year plan and the experience economy as part of that. One of the ways I did it, I sat on the stage and they said, what are you looking for? To a room full of people, I said, I want to talk to people who can tell me what 2028 looks like. And then a bunch of people come up to me afterwards saying, I'll show you what it looks like. And just like put an advert in a newspaper years ago saying, I'm looking for people who can show me what the future looks like. And then never underestimate the power of LinkedIn. LinkedIn is unbelievable to be able to get hold of this industry, which is growing, emerging, because people are sharing what they're doing. You get introduced to different people and then you reach out to people that you don't know. Because it's a highly creative industry that's experiencing an accelerated growth, people really want to talk to you. There's a lot of excitement about this industry. It is embryonic. It is a bit chaotic. But with technology advancing at the speed it is, with technology becoming cheaper to produce these experiences, and that marriage between these writers and storytellers and experts in the field, the opportunity with it is incredible.
Absolutely incredible. I want to come back to that thing that you were talking about. Obviously, here at Excel, it is a building, it's infrastructure, and kind of keeping up with technological change. Firstly, can we start with what you're doing with Immerse London and then move on to how you keep up with the physical infrastructure constraints that you have?
In this city that I've lived in for 25 years and I love, it's very, very hard to do something for the first time. It's such a rare opportunity. So being able to create London's first immersive entertainment district is an honour and is a bit of a gift, to be honest. To be able to do it on the waterfront in the Royal Docks, we're sat here looking at the moment.
For our listeners, we are sat in the most beautiful room in Excel and I can see right up and down the Thames.
So to be able to do that and create a destination, we're running King Tutankhamun at the moment. On the way here, we saw all the school children excited about doing it. And they're going to go in there and they're going to have a huge projection room telling a story of King Tutankhamun, which they've probably never seen anything of that size before. They're going to go into a VR experience that will blow their mind. They've got a hologram experience. They've got a VR experience in the metaverse where they actually walk through Valley of the Kings and into a tomb. And I've seen the reactions from my son and from other kids in it. Is a brilliant thing to be able to host that in the education space. Being able to create those memories for people and bring them to this part of London is really wholesome, and that you get a chance to really affect the way people feel. That's important. If people can come away going, do you know what? I absolutely love that. And you see the reviews and you understand if you're doing a good job with it. So then to create this destination, there are a lot more elements that we will be adding as we go through. I can't talk about all of them. Some of them are under NDA. Some of them are subject to planning consent. But our aspirations are to grow it beyond the five chapters that will be open in August and to utilize the water and other opportunities that are here.
And really make it a destination.
Yes.
I think the words you used were urban theme park.
Yes, it has been described as that. So far, since we launched in 2022, we've had 1.4 million visitors come. From August, on an annualized basis, with five chapters open, we'd be about 2.2, 2.3 million visitors, which would pop us into the top 10 of London attractions, which is quite remarkable from a standing start. With more to come, suddenly we take that responsibility very, very seriously. That's a large volume of people that need looking after. They need to be safe. They need to be watered. They need to be fed. And they need to come away going, I had a great time. I want to come back. I want to do that again.
And do you think this is the future of venues? We've got a lot of people who are our listeners who will have venues that they're struggling to perhaps settle space to, that they do the traditional conferences and exhibitions in. What would you say to them in terms of trying to expand?
We're very fortunate at XL in that we have extremely high occupancy rates for conferences and exhibitions. And we're just about to open our extension, which is another 25,000 square meters. Where Immerse London complements our core business is if the business part of the day is done 9 till 5:30, there's a huge amount of social, huge amount of business gets done in the bar or in the restaurant or after the show. And when you've been in an exhibition hall, as you know, I have many, many times, and you've been in a extremely functional box that has no natural light, that has lots of exhibition stands and thousands of people, you really crave to be outside of that box.
Yeah.
So if you could be on a waterfront, or you could be in an immersive King Tutankhamun experience, if you could be watching and listening to Elvis, that level of escapism, if you can do it with your clients and you can do it with your colleagues and you can do it on the campus, then suddenly it becomes interesting. And one of the things that we're now going to start to turn on as everything opens is that we've got the opportunity for corporate takeovers. Instead of running a get together on your stand, you might want to book out Elvis and take everyone for a performance, or you might want to book out a restaurant on the waterfront. But because all of these opportunities lend themselves to sort of 200 to 400 people, you can then own that. And with the digital, you can own that experience and take it over. How does that make people feel and remember your brand and that experience, in opposed to we've hired an area in a bar, come along for some nibbles? And I think it also plays into the changing attitudes and a generational change towards alcohol and that sense of, I want something more and beyond this. I'd like an interaction that isn't just, oh, here's some sausage rolls and some bad wine and some beer, which is, for the exhibitions industry, been fairly staple for certainly the only time I've been there. So I think it allows us to offer a different tone of voice. It allows us to affect the way people feel, and it allows us to work with brands and organizers and exhibitors to do something that people go, that was amazing.
And this is the core of experiential marketing. What do you want people to feel, think, say, 100%. Do about your brand once you've gone? So it's 100%. Brilliant. And so it doesn't really feel like a related diversification. It feels like part of a holistic offering that brings the experiential back into the traditional way of working. Do you think that was accelerated post-COVID? Do you think we had to have a bit of a reset and rethink, or do you think it was always on the cards?
I think COVID was the first time in my life, having been in exhibitions and events all of my career, and now immersive entertainment, it was the first time I actually thought, I need to go and I've got to retrain. I'm going to do something else. And we come out of it and we're all sort of looking at each other going, are we okay? Is everything okay? And what happened, certainly here at XL, was remarkable. The bounce back, we were 19% busier than we were pre-COVID. And there's several reasons for that. I think people treat exhibitions and conferences now as a holiday away from working from home. They don't see their colleagues all the time. They look forward to that and they want to make the most of it. So they want to stay in a hotel. They want to be immersed in their industry and they want to be together. They want to be together more than they did, because when it got taken away, you realized how good it was. The exhaust of that is also the experience economy has hugely benefited from COVID and that need to want to interact. But I also think digital is fueling it in a twofold way. I think that we spend more time looking at these little boxes in our pockets than we ever have, because they are addictive. They've got powerful algorithms. They've got all of the fun stuff on there. You just spend more time looking at it, whether you're second screening, how many people watch a film and actually watch a film? You can physically leave the thing alone. How many conversations you have with your phones on the table is there to distract you. our bodies are actually craving some time away from it. And an immersive experience gives you that time to not look at that because you are captivated and you are immersed in. I remember going to the Secret Cinema a very long time ago and they took my phone off me and put it in a pouch. And I was like, great, brilliant. And I was at the Royal Albert Hall at the weekend and they did it. And there's lots of people like really unhappy about it. I was like, no, it's setting you free. It's liberating you for an hour and a half, 2 hours. Be free. I'd like to see more of that. I think restaurants do it where they give you a discount if you check your phone. There's some restaurants that do that now. Like you get a 10% discount if you check your phone because they want you to be in the restaurant. They don't want you sat there because it's too addictive. I think digital is fueling that in that people are seeking escapism and immersive entertainment does that. I also think that the same thing is fueling the experience economy because everyone's a broadcaster. Everyone wants to document it. I wrote a little note internally. It was about King Tutankhamun especially. And I said, do not underestimate the power and influence of mums and dads that want to look good on Instagram to their followers that they're taking their kids to an educational, historical exhibition. I said, they're all broadcasters. They all want to show their friends and people that, look at us doing this thing. It's a big audience. And because everyone's a broadcaster, they want to document it. They all want the pictures. They all want to upload it. They want to show it. Years ago, your neighbors went on holiday. They'd invite you around for a slideshow on their holiday. Like now, nobody does that because the slideshow's on Instagram or TikTok or whatever it is. But it's the same thing. People want the content. They want to share the content. They want to be in the moment. So it's that balance.
How do you balance that? How do you design experiences so that they're entirely shareable, but you don't have your phone with you at the same time?
I think it depends on the experience. Some no phones, 100% subscribe to that. Some take as much as you want because they want the shareable content, because they want the organic social. Some restrict at certain points and allow others. And I think it depends on the experience. The music industry is a great example. All those gigs where people are just filming. I mean, come on, just be in that moment. But they want to be in the moment. They want to film it. Why do they want to film it? Because they want to share it. Because they want to tell people they were there. So it's that battle.
But there is something beautifully exclusive about being immersed in something completely. So you've taken me back to the Katy Perry moment in space where she was looking more in the camera than she was looking at space itself. But it's that thing where I mentioned some experiences earlier. You've mentioned Secret Cinema, You, Me, My Bum Bum Train. These things have huge kudos from the FOMO that's created by the fact that the thing that you have when you go beyond the gates is something that you can't share or replicate.
It's Willy Wonka's factory, isn't it? If you can't buy a ticket, it's not ready and available. I mean, You and Me Bum Bum Train is a very unique example. It's very, very clever. Scarcity of tickets. You can only guarantee to be a part of it if you volunteer. But it's not really attached to a business model and a year-round thing. Pops up, it goes quiet for a long time, it comes back. So I think when you make that a permanent thing, you make it a Madame Tussauds, it'll lose that fairy dust. So it's part of that huge appeal that it's rare and it is for a short amount of time. As soon as you turn that into a year-round thing, it would change. Our model for this is that there are, we call them chapters because we are big blank pages for these storytellers to come and tell their stories. Chapter one, which straddles the waterfront and then above in the exhibition halls, because we have the Formula E Electric Motor Racing Championship come through the chapter itself, it has to break every July, which is a challenge. So that will always host immersive touring exhibitions, as with Jurassic World, Disney 100, Formula One, and now King Tutankhamun. So that we run two a year in there every year. And they've been highly successful since we started doing that. For chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5, the tenancies range between 3 and 10 years. One of the things that we've learned about this space is that what used to happen was companies would go into a meanwhile space. They would have huge costs on heating and cooling, and huge costs on toilets. Toilets are ridiculously expensive. They break, they go wrong. And converting an existing retail space to suddenly take 400 or 500 people throws up a number of challenges. What we've created is spaces dedicated for the immersive entertainment industry, where they don't worry about the heating, they don't worry about the cooling, don't worry about the toilets. That's all our responsibility. Don't worry about power, data, all of that. The maintenance of that is us. So they can focus on being the storytellers, on the production, on the actors, on the tech and everything else. These boxes, because they are their boxes that they've leased, when they reach the end of a cycle and they start seeing those algorithms on ticket sales start to mature and reach saturation, they then got the next thing that they want to put in there. Elvis might run for 3 years, might run for five, it might run longer. Same with Friends and other things. But the IP owner, they dictate when they turn the new thing on and do that, which gives them that power and autonomy. And I think what used to be a problem was that people would rent a space and they might have an absolute knockout of a show. So I remember Secret Cinema were in Canning Town in a building that was being redeveloped for Stranger Things, and they sold more tickets than they ever imagined, and they had huge demand. They were sold out. They had to get out. They had something that was selling 15,000 tickets a week, but they had to get out because it was being converted into apartments. And then equally, if you take a lease on somewhere and you've got an IP that isn't working, you're still bound into that and the costs that go with it. For a number of these businesses, having multi IPs and using it as their London HQ, if you like, works really well.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the podcast, but I could talk to you for hours about all of this. More than anything, I feel really grateful that you're leading the future of entertainment as we see it now, immersive entertainment. No, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a wonderful model, and I really hope everybody engages. Talk to me about the things that are coming up. So you've got Tutankhamun at the moment, you've got Elvis Evolution coming up, and Squid Game.
Squid Game opens next week. Elvis opens for previews in July. I've got one I can't talk about yet. Probably will be able to in about 3 weeks.
Exciting.
Very exciting. It's all about being an A-list celebrity and that world that comes with it. Then we've got another blockbuster coming in October, which I can't talk about.
Of course not. How nice that there's this constant stream of exciting things going on. I love it. So I am here on the floor at IBTM World speaking to Kat Bottable, who's Business Development Director of Secret Cinema. Kat heads up Studio Secret Cinema, which is a brand experience agency that applies Secret Cinema's immersive creativity to other business events and marketing activity, which is such a brilliant premise. We all need more Secret Cinema in our lives. But you've got it distilled, haven't you, down to one word that you were talking about on stage. I like that you're looking around going, what is that word, Shanali? It was awe, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I'm going to say two words.
Two
collective
words.
Awe.
Collective
specifically.
Awe. Great. Tell me about collective awe.
So collective awe is a type of emotion that we experience when we are all moving in unison as a group of people. So it's an emotion that is triggered often by types of experiences in modern day society. Could be a gig, a stadium gig. Could be a live theatre show, could be a secret cinema show, could be going to run a marathon in a city with thousands of other people, could be going on an organised walk with a group of other people, could be going to watch a sports game. But this idea that a collective large group of people are all moving their bodies in unison together, kind of in this active participatory way, triggers this type of emotion called awe. It stems from collective effervescence, which is a term coined by a sociologist in the early 20th century called Emile Durkheim. And he coined that phrase whilst he was studying religious experience and how powerful that can be and what's the science behind that. And it is a term that we've been looking at off the back of some research, or it's a concept we've been looking at off the back of some research that we've done earlier this year at Secret Cinema, looking into why our experiences have been so powerful. We have loads of anecdotal feedback about how powerful they have been and how people remember them. Most people I speak to in London have a story to tell me about going to a Secret Cinema experience, whether it was 15 years ago or five. So we wanted to look into the science behind that and work out why, partly because now we're working with lots of other brands and businesses to help them make their events more impactful. We wanted to understand a bit more why that is and what are the tools and the techniques we've been using over the years to deliver that powerful effect. And then the entertainment experience side of Secret Cinema, we've been looking at it to really just understand how audience mindsets have changed, I guess, over the last years. We've been going for 17 years, so obviously people have really changed. So much has happened in those 17 years. And really understand what people are looking for and what drives them now to go and spend money on immersive entertainment and
Brilliant.
Live events in general.
The big question is, have audiences changed?
one of the key things that we found universally that motivates people to want to go to live events is to be awestruck. So that was like one of the first things that we found through our research. I think 80% of people through our research study agreed that that was what they wanted. So the number two motivation that we found, again, 80% of people agreed, was to connect to people. Then wanting to connect, not necessarily always to strangers, but connect more deeply to their friends and family and the people around them. They wanted to create memories and deepen their kind of shared experiences together. And then the third reason of why people attend live events was to connect to themselves. And that's 76% of people that we interviewed agreed that connecting to myself was a real driver to attend live events. And I think events really offer people a chance to explore their identities in a time where we've been, I guess, trained and conditioned by algorithms to explore identities very digitally for many years now. And my hunch here is that in a way you do end up a little bit disconnected. I think there's a lot of cultural theory around this idea of like the fragmented self and how your digital identity and how it quite often can be very different to your IRL identity. And maybe after years of really focusing on our digital identities, people are now feeling a little bit disconnected with themselves. And who is that person I've created to represent myself digitally? So I feel like this insight that we've got from our research is really interesting for everybody that works in events. We've come to see these three pillars of motivation as the pursuit of collective awe. And that's a concept, I guess, that we feel is really exciting and is driving a lot of our work that we're doing at Studio Secret Cinema with different brands, but also in our productions too. Our shows, our experiences are quite large scale with quite large audiences of around 800 or so people. And there's so many different elements and techniques and tools and tricks that we're using and have been using for such a long time now. Within those, when you just take one or two of them out and use those two techniques together in a much smaller environment, maybe a one-off event that's only a couple of hours, they can still be very powerful. So for example, within one of our experiences, we might often have these side rooms or side spaces that will still be dressed in the world of the film or the TV show or the game with Game IP now. These side rooms, we would historically treat them, you know, as their own little mini performance spaces, and they'll be dressed and programmed with activities and performers and characters and things for audiences to do, interaction moments, participation moments. But like maybe only 50 people out of the 800 that come to the show would only ever experience that. And actually, that little microcosm, you lift that and take those tools and techniques and sort of recreate just those parts for a brand event, smaller audience, that still creates the same impact and power that the 50 people that had come to that in the show had. So yeah, I think we're breaking down all of the things that we've been doing, our toolkit, as it were, and then applying them for brand events. So for example, one of the things I've just been talking about on stage, which I feel like is a really simple thing and you can apply it very interestingly into a conference environment, is what I'd call a gateway drug. And this is something that we, again, have been using for years. So for our shows often, so it will be a prop or an inanimate object, a small thing that you can give to people or leave out for people to pick up or ask them to bring in from home. And it could be as simple as a paper aeroplane, as such in a project that we did recently with Have Us Play actually for EE, where we used a paper aeroplane as a very simple device left on people's seats for them to find when they arrived, and allowed them, they had something to interact with that wasn't a character or a performer or a brand ambassador. And then playing with that becomes the gateway, essentially, for a performer or a brand ambassador to be able to interact with that person in a way that we know from our experience, that person will be much more likely and comfortable to have that interaction than if you just try and interact with people as soon as they arrive. And we've done it in our shows for years. often because we have so many people coming, it will be an item to bring from home. So for example, in Bridgerton, we ask people to bring an old key or old keys to use as currency within the experience. For Star Wars, people ask to bring in old earth junk, broken technology or circuit boards, and they could trade that in for spice, which was then essentially rocks and sand that they could use as currency within the experience. Guardians of the Galaxy, we asked people to bring in old mixtapes or CDs. Guardians of the Galaxy was 2 years ago, and I think that's an item that people could bring in and happily leave at the experience because I feel like poor CDs and tapes have really lost their value to a lot of people. Not everybody. So this idea of a gateway drug, thinking about the conference environment, suddenly I'm like, is this a new way to reimagine conference merch, which I feel like we are slightly changing our view on because of the environment, which is good. I am still seeing around the conference hall printed items, things with logos on, which I think because of the environment, obviously lots of people are taking a more planet-friendly approach. So thinking about sustainable materials, but also about making merch that's useful. So it's a thing that you will keep and use, as opposed to just some of the things I've seen over the years, which are just filling landfill. But I think if you start thinking about conference merch and leaving something on a seat that can be that gateway to an interaction or gateway to some participatory thing.
Well, I mean, definitely, I think Collective Aura is a brilliant way of considering how we bring more interaction into our events going forward.
What an incredible episode. Absolutely love talking to Kat Botterbaugh. I mean, so many learnings from Secret Cinema. I love that she used the term collective awe and how people with shared experience and collective awe remember those experiences. And that was really also highlighted by Damien when he talked about some of the experiences that they're running here that bring people together. It was great to hear some of the science behind that. I loved that we're building on the theory of effervescence that Durkheim found in religion and making that part of a multi-sensorial digital experience that really embeds things in our minds. Can we leave our phones behind and be fully immersed in something? And can it change the way we look at the world? We're firmly talking here about transformation economy, which we believe is the next iteration of economy after all these experiences we're delivering. And that's why it's so important to look forward, to find time to listen to podcasts like these, to go and be a part of immersive experiences, to see what the world is going to be like in 2028 when we integrate with digital more. And like Kat said, understand the science behind that. And like Damien said, be at the forefront of that. He thinks right now we're in this embryonic, chaotic phase of understanding what immersion means. And it's fueled by this digital explosion and the need to interact. And where will that take us? Well, listener, that is over to you. Go out, find your imagination, be immersed and enjoy. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everyone. Claudia Hall here, Exhibition Director for IBTM World. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, New in Events. Your host for season 2 is Shanali Devereaux and executive producer is Mike Fletcher. Don't forget to mark your calendar for IBTM World in Barcelona, taking place from the 18th to 20th of November. And if you found this episode insightful, please share it with anyone else you think may appreciate it. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.